Okay, what I'll try to do, first of all, is just give you a resume of what's going on and what we're thinking about for the immediate future and for the far future, and you can begin to see where you fit in, and then we'll go on to questions. I think that probably we'll get more to the kind of thing you really want to hear in the question hour than in what I have in mind to present. I just finished up a 30-day trip through Mexico, Venezuela, or Mexico, Costa Rica, Colombia, Venezuela, Brazil, and Argentina. And so what I think I'll do is give you a rundown of kind of how I see it as of February 23rd, 1974. And kind of what the state of the union is. Let me draw this out here first for you. We're going to have an awful short continent here. See, Columbia got to be the wrong size here. I hope there are no Latins here to see this. And I hope that you don't try to travel by this map, because you'd never get there. But here we have Mexico, and there are six Central American countries, and then we have Guyana here, and here's Venezuela, here's Colombia, here's Ecuador, Peru, Bolivia, Brazil, Chile, Paraguay, here's Uruguay, and Argentina. Brazil speaks Portuguese and has 100 million people. The rest of South America speaks Spanish and has another 100 million people. And Central America, Mexico, speaks Spanish and has maybe 50 million people. Those are very round figures. Okay, so we have 250 million people about that we're dealing with. We started the ministry in Mexico in about 1965 and got off to a kind of a tough start. Just didn't click. And the reason was, basically, we did not scope out some of these things that we were talking about this morning. And I think that there are two fundamental things that we have to bear in mind if we're going to be successful in a Latin American or a Latin culture, whether it's in Europe or whether it's in South America or Central and South America or Latin America. These two fundamental principles, one of them is to be careful with your identity with the Protestant church. Now, this may really sound weird to you, and I almost hesitate to really get into it, but feel free to ask me questions about this later. But in a sense, the Reformation never really took place in these countries. And Protestantism really comes out of the Reformation, and what is there in the Protestant Church is seen by the world as the Protestant movement. That's what Protestant really means, is we're Protestants. And so we say now, join us in our protest. And that's what the message, when we present the gospel from a Protestant context, that's what it is understood to be among, and understand this, not among the lower classes, but among the intellectuals and university students, that is what it is understood to be. Join us in our protest. And they're not interested in the protest. And so the problem is that the message does not come across crystal clear, the just shall live by faith. It's wrapped up in this religious conflict. And so we find that we have tremendous access to the world and tremendous communication with the pagan when we do not operate out of the context of the Protestant bloc. And so that is basic to success in Latin America. And then the other one is that to be sure that your methods and your forms grow out of the culture rather than come in from outside. I say those would be the two keys to success. Well, in about 1970, Dan Travis and Mert Martin arrived in Mexico, and the fellows had been kind of psyched out by what they'd heard about the Mexican, that you can't do this with the Mexican, you can't do that with the Mexican, and their orientation was pretty much from kind of the Protestant missionary effort. And really, there was really nothing to show for the years, you know, about the 6 years that they had been working. And so about this time, the TACO program, which was a program where a number of American fellows went down to Mexico for a summer training program, Dan had about three or four of these summer trainees with him. And every day they'd get up in the morning and wait for their leader to lead them out into something. And their leader sat there and didn't know what to do because he'd been told, you know, to not make aggressive contact with the world and so on, because it wasn't going to work. Well, he was studying Romans 1 at the time. He came across verse 16, where it says, I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ. It is the power of God unto salvation to everyone who believes. And he looked at that and he says, well, now, perhaps that's true. You know? And he said, I believe that it is true. And so they began to go out and just make cold contacts and witness to guys, and they were surprised that people were open, interested, and they got some decisions. Now, these decisions didn't stick, but that really is beside the point, because it was a major breakthrough, nevertheless, because they discovered that they could communicate with the Mexican non-Christian student. And it wasn't long until they got a hold of the idea of treating evangelism as a process and of operating on these premises that we just described. And it didn't take very long for the ministry to really take hold. The first time I was there was in September this year. And they have a group of 13 guys and gals that form the basic nucleus. 9 guys, 4 gals. And each one of them have a ministry going. And they're all just raw new Christians. None of them are more than 2 years old in the Lord. But very healthy and very aggressive in their evangelism. Like, you know, we'll go out and shoot baskets or something, while those guys will go out and evangelize. That's kind of the way they feel about it. And so Mexico is really off and moving. And I was impressed with two fellows. I'd like to write their names down in case, you know, God leads you to pray for Mexico. Probably two fellows that are most promising for the future. Sergio and Rafael. Sergio is of Spanish descent and is a very gifted little leader. I've never met a guy that's more of a natural leader than Sergio. And Rafael just graduated from university. I don't know what he graduated in, but he has moved to the city of Puebla, where Dick Miller is working and is geared in to help Dick in the ministry. Now, we have quite a staff there. Dan Travis is in charge, and then Sam Clark is in, Dan is in Mexico City. Sam Clark is also in Mexico City. Now, Sam has about 15 years of history in Latin America, and there's no man in Latin America that is more valuable than Sam. Sam is a monster in the Bible. He really knows the scriptures. And that's one of the things that we most need in Latin America, are men who can really take the scriptures apart and then expound them. Because the guys that we lead to Christ, man, most of them don't even know there are two testaments in the Bible when we meet them. And, well, you can imagine just the content that, and the information, the teaching and stuff that they need before they become mature and really established. And that's Sam's bag. Is just feeding the gang. He gets them together and preaches at them for hours, and they just eat it up. And then there's Carlos Ricoy, who is a Mexican. He's also in Mexico City. Dick Miller is down in Puebla, and he's only been in the country about a year and a half, just kind of getting on the road. Still, you know, wobbly on the language. And he'll just take a little bit more time to get to more altitude. And then we have two new guys come in. Jim Harrelson and Paul Reynoso. They call him Pablo Reynoso there. Some of you guys maybe know him. But both of them have quite a background in Spanish, and it's not going to take them very long to pick up the language. So the team looks good, pretty good balance, and they've got it figured out now. You know, they've figured out what the Mexican is like, and so I feel that the roots are there. They're on their way. Well, then went down to Costa Rica, which is right in here. And this is run by a guy by the name of Jorge Davila. I'll write his name down. Any of you know Jorge? Anybody know this guy, Davila? Well, he's a Costa Ricense, which means you know, he's from Costa Rica. And he's been around for a number of years, and has a, you know, Sam Clark's tracks are all over him. You know, he's you can just see that Sam has been pouring the scriptures into him for years, and the guy is strong and mature. But he hasn't had a whole lot of help in getting things off the ground there in Costa Rica, and the ministry has really gone through some travail in the last couple of years. Two of his best men, the men that were his buddies and he was counting on, bailed out in the last year. And one of them, when he bailed out, took the whole university crowd with him. And so he just, you know, kind of reconstructing the thing from scratch right now. And I really appreciate you praying for Jorge. And his wife is Saida. So what we have there, we have a national leader, but we don't have much of a national work because it got bombed out. And our plan is to beef up this team with some we'd like to find some good, mature men who can go in there, single guys, who can go in there as sort of ITs, who already have the language and could work in under Jorge and help him put together a team there in Costa Rica. Well, we surveyed Colombia and Venezuela slipped around here, supposed to be over here a little bit. Well, we surveyed Colombia and Venezuela on this trip, and both countries are very workable for us. I'm anxious to get in there. We have our team pretty well picked for Venezuela. Ken Graham is going to go in. He'll be going to the Toronto Institute of Linguistics in June, and then he'll be going to language school in Costa Rica, spend a year there, and maybe I'm scooping somebody, but John Decking will probably join the team. So it'll be a team of two, maybe three. We'd like to get a Latin on the team, but we're not sure where he's going to come from. Well, then got down to Brazil. Arrived there about about 1 o'clock in the morning, arrived there alone. George Sanchez and Ken Graham went with me. Mexico, Central America, Colombia, Venezuela. And then they went north and I went south. And so I arrived in São Paulo down here alone on the morning of, I forget when it was, I think the 10th of the month, something like, no, 2nd of February I arrived there. And got up in the morning about 8:45 and looked out my hotel window, and there were some fire engines going by, and I looked out the window, and there was this building that was beginning to burn. Maybe you heard about this fire where about 190 people burned. And so I pulled on some clothes and went down and watched it, and there was this 25-story building, flames going up the middle, and all the windows were just crammed with people that had, you know, they had no place for them to go. They'd gone out outside the windows. There was enough of a ledge outside the windows so that they could stand on the ledge. And then there were maybe 200 people up on the roof. And the fire would leap from one room to the next, and you could see the fire boiling around inside the window. And then the window would explode, and the fire would come out of the windows like a blowtorch, and the people would either leap or burn. So I stood there for 3 hours watching people die. And it's sort of, it's the kind of thing that you just can't cope with when you see it. But I think that I'm telling you this because it kind of punctuates how I feel about the whole thing. As I stood there, Luke 13:1-3 came to mind, where Jesus was commenting on the headlines of the day. He said, now those 18 people that died when the tower fell, did you think that they were any more wicked than everybody else? He says, no. He says, but I tell you, unless you repent, you will also likewise perish. And what Jesus is saying is that these events remind us of the fact that every person we meet, as we walk down the street, is just like those people in that burning building. And, you know, as you go from one country to the next, Mexico City has 8 million people, then you get to Colombia and Bogota has a couple million people, and you get to Caracas and has a couple million people, and then you get to Sao Paulo and it has another 8 million, and you get downtown to Buenos Aires and you have another 8 million people. And you have these huge population centers, and these people, you go down the streets, they just bombard you. You just can't cope with it. And then you begin to ask yourself the question, well, now, what is God doing? See, is God going to redeem these people, or isn't he? Whose responsibility is it? And it happened that at the time I was meditating in the book of Ephesians. And in chapter 1, it talks about, this is, now God demonstrated his power when he raised Jesus from the dead. And then he kept raising him above all principalities, above all powers, above every name that could be named now, or even any name that you could think of in the future. Jesus was raised and he's above all of those. In other words, he is total power. And so it says, now God demonstrated his power in what he did to Jesus. He raised him not only from the dead, but to raise him above every power that ever existed. And of course, his resurrection, the minute he stepped out of the grave, Satan and his plans and everything else was doomed. Well, then in chapter 3, verse 20, he says, now that very same power is at work in you. And he says, if you can have above what you can ask or think, and it will be done according to that power which is at work in you, the same power that raised Jesus from the dead. And so you think, you know, some wild thought. You think, well, now, what could I ask God for? And you think, well, would I dare ask God for millions? Well, if I can think it, if I can imagine it, then I already know that thought is obsolete, because he will do above what you can think. Well, so I'm trying to think the wildest thoughts I possibly can think, so that God is going to have to be one up on me all the time. Because he says he's going to do more than you can think. Well, But the frustrating part is, you see the promises of God, the tremendous statements in the book of Ephesians, then you see what's going on and what is not going on in these countries, and you ask yourself, well, you know, how do you put the two together? Well, in chapter 3 in Ephesians, in one of the verses he says now, or in chapter 2, he describes how the Gentiles are fellow heirs with the Jews. They're built on the same foundation, the apostles and prophets, and this was a mystery which was hidden for in ages past, and now Paul reveals it. And then in chapter 3, one of the early verses, he says, now I've revealed this, he says, I've just shared this mystery with you, and he says, God revealed it to me, and he goes on and describes it. Well, I've always passed over that, you know, God revealed a mystery to Paul, that was fine. Actually, it was a very significant thing. Because what did that mystery contain? Well, it was the fact that the gospel was available to the Gentile world. And if Paul had not gotten that mystery, it would have remained in the hands of the Jews, and the Christian movement never would have gotten off the ground. It was the Romans, not the Jews, that scattered the gospel to the corners of the earth. The Jews never really did get out of Jerusalem. And they never did get out of their little world. They never got over their hang-ups in dealing with Gentiles. And the first martyrs were among the Praetorian Guard, or the Romans, the soldiers, who were the first martyrs. And so it took, you know, the Gentile to scatter the gospel. And so Paul's discovery, the mystery, that the gospel is also for the Gentile, was key in getting the gospel to that generation. So I asked myself the question, now how did Paul get that mystery? Maybe a voice came out of the wall one night and says, you know, voice of God, Paul, I have a mystery for you. Yes, go ahead, I'm writing. That's not the way it worked. Because in Ephesians chapter, or Galatians chapter 1, you find out that Paul spent years getting that mystery. He spent years in the Word, prayer, searching his own soul, consulting with Peter after he got it all through. It was a matter of travail. Of course, the Holy Spirit revealed it to him, maybe progressively, maybe all at once, maybe it dawned on him. Then he went back and double-checked it and so on. But it was based on the Scriptures. And what he says in that mystery, you find it in the Old Testament. It's there. But the point is that a man with an idea, an insight into the Scriptures, made the difference in the first generation. Well, Luther did the same thing. Luther didn't sit down and think, say, now I'm going to start the Reformation. He was a tortured soul. And all he was trying to do was find out how to relate himself to God. And in his travail, he stumbled across Romans 1:17. The just shall live by faith. He who by faith is just shall live. And it blew the lid off of the gospel. And once again, the gospel got around to the whole world. And it, not to the whole world, but, you know, an enormous part of it, and it established whole cultures based on the Reformation. Once again, a man uncovered something which had been hidden for centuries, but it was there all the time. See, I think we have something in the concept of multiplication, but I don't think that the concept has come to maturity yet. And I think that there's some place in that Bible, maybe on a page or on every page of it, once we begin to see it, that will result in the same thing, where we're going to blow the lid off the gospel and we're going to get it to the millions. And I cannot be content with a little band of 20 people who spend their lives perfecting themselves, but who have no vision for the world. I think we need to go for quality, but let's remember that there are 3,700,000,000 people out there. So that's kind of what was going on inside of me as I took this trip. But let me get back to the what's going on in Brazil. It was really funny. You know, I spent 10 years down there, and these guys were my buddies. Aldo, Ken, Mario, and Elisio, and Evilazio, and the other fellows that are in charge now. Well, I'd always been sort of a blood brother, carrying on the ministry. Well, now I came back, and it wasn't the same anymore. And they kind of looked at me with a little bit of suspicion, wondering if I was still one of them or if I had sold out to the system, you know. because, you know, now I'm handling some administration stuff for them, and you know, it's just a different deal. And so it took about a day to kind of get over that and for the guys to realize that, you know, things are the same. But it's really interesting because, and one of the reasons why they're a little bit, you know, wondering about my visit was they've come up with some very innovative things. One of them is this. When we started out, we started, of course, like I said, with just only pagans. Well, then we got into a ministry with the German Lutheran Church, which we always kept separate, but it involved, you know, several thousand people who have come to Christ and who are in that context. And so we have religious Christians, we have non-religious Christians. We have two departments, see. And on the upper levels, in the disciple maker level and so on, they get together and fellowship and share ideas and minister together. But on the grassroots level, we have to keep them separate because they're just two different expressions of Christianity. Well, we needed some men for the ministry. So I think the first one was Fernando Gonzalez. We pulled him out of his job and began to support him. And then there was Aldo. And the next one was Osvaldo. And the next one was Mario. And then Elisio. And then Luis Marcos. And then Carlos. I think there are about seven or eight guys that are now being supported. Well, we found out that We were producing men a lot faster than we were producing money. And so some of these guys began to really feel the pinch financially. And they're really sacrificing to carry on the ministry. They just do without sometimes. And it's just tough. And we have maybe 25 or 30 guys who, you know, if we had the finances, we could put them in the ministry and we could expand a lot faster. But I thank God for this check, because it can be very easy to take some young guy and say, okay, now he wants to go into ministry, we can use him and just plunk him into ministry and doesn't really earn his spurs. And so we realized that we had to establish a financial base which would really be solid if the ministry is going to continue to grow. And we also realized this, that the whole idea of taking guys when they are ready, and raising money for them, and putting them in ministry, is a cultural thing. It's an American way of doing things. And, you know, the American, up until, you know, the last few months, which I think may have some very good effects, until the last few months, anything he can conceive of, he'll be able to finance it somehow or other. And you find that also in our navigator strategy. Anything we can kind of conceive of, we'll finance. But then you get into a third world country where the economy just, you know, can't handle that kind of thing. And you operate on that premise, you're going to go bankrupt. And so I think that, and these are decisions that I made, I think I made some mistakes where we put some of these guys into the thing before they were, we had the financial backing to carry them. So they had to come up with a new concept just for providing the leadership and financing the men to carry on the ministry. It's not a drawback that they don't have the money. We have to understand that. What we have to do is come up with the Brazilian way of funding the ministry. And what they came up with was this. More emphasis on a guy remaining part-time for a while. I think four of the guys that are in the ministry are dentists, and two of them went back, opened up their dental offices half-time, and are supporting themselves half-time, carrying the ministry half-time, and people are giving to them. And instead of going in next year, you know, full-time, they may spend 4 or 5 years building up a financial root system for themselves. And once the ministry pushes them out of their professions, then they go into it. Another thing we discovered was this. I guess it sounds like all I'm doing is sharing my mistakes. I came in as sort of I came in as a full-time deal. My background, I was an art major, planning on, you know, painting and stuff, and I took off and you know, did this navigator thing, and got to Brazil, and the guys, you know, saw me doing what I was doing, and, you know, full-time, I think, well, you know, that's the way to be a good Christian, is to be a full-timer. And then that was confirmed, underscored, by the fact that we pulled out seven men out of their professions and put them in a ministry. And there is built in to the human mind, I think, this idea that the number one Christians are the full-timers. And that if you go on and carry on your profession, that somehow or other you're a second-rate citizen in the kingdom of God. And so if you really want to be serious about the work of God, you forget the Mickey Mouse and get on with the job. The Mickey Mouse being anything to do with normal life, and the job being preaching the gospel. Well, what has happened then was that we had two classes of people, and a young guy, he'd come into the group, and he'd look at us, and he'd be making decisions. We discovered this later. He'd be making decisions when he was first getting in as to whether he was willing to go full-time or not. And if he was willing to go full-time, he'd hang in there. And if he wasn't, he'd disappear. And we'd see some real fine guys that would just kind of fade off. And we couldn't figure out why. And then we found other guys who were kind of hanging in there. And we discovered that their motive was that they felt that, well, the thing to do eventually is to be full-time. And this is something we've never said. In fact, we preach the other way. You know, we're producing men to be lifetime disciples, and that's our whole pitch. We're producing people who will be lifetime disciples so that the day they step in their graves, they will still be loving God and winning people to Christ and multiplying spiritually. And that we want people to be a part of their world in their professions and carrying on a ministry on that level. And the exceptions, it's the freaks that go full-time. See? Well, we said that, but what we did, weighed 100 while, 100 pounds, while what we said weighed 1 pound. And so they got what we did much more loud and clear than what we said. And so the guys right now are correcting this mistake. And it's tough when you correct a mistake to stay in balance. But what we're trying to do is teach men that work is honorable, that they should go into their professions and excel in their professions, do a good job, and put their households together, put their families together, and then as God prospers them in the ministry, it may take them 4 or 5 years, it may take them 10 years. It took Joe Simmons in New Zealand 20 years to work out of his job and to take over, move full-time into the ministry. And so there's this concept where when his own fruit can support him, then he goes into the ministry. So that slows down the production or the availability of our men, but it's a kind of thing that we can live with, indefinitely. And we have to build into the system in Latin America. The methods have got to be consistent with the economy so that if all of a sudden they saw off the USA and tow it out to sea and sink it, it's not going to sink this along with it. You see? So that's what I found that the guys are working on. And so there's a strong emphasis on teaching men how to administrate their own funds. One of the things we found is that the Latin, these guys that are going into the profession, they're doctors and dentists and lawyers and engineers and so on, they're good technicians in their fields. But they come from families that have never had any money. They don't know how to administrate their money. They make a lot of money, but they still have financial problems. They don't know how to administrate their business. They don't know how to administrate their own private lives. They don't know how to relate to their wives properly. They don't know how to be good fathers. They don't know how to just live life. And so we find that the thing we're emphasizing now among the graduates and the professional people is just how to live life. And we look at the university ministry as sort of a feeder ministry. That's not our main bag. Now, it doesn't mean that we do it on the backstroke. But we recognize that the university ministry is not going to produce impact either now nor in the future. It never will. And the reason it never will is that it ends in 4 or 5 years for every individual that comes in. So you have a constant turnover. Now, the only way we'll ever make impact is by hanging on to the men and help them make the transition into the real world and helping them be fruitful in the NAV vision in the real world, which means that really the name of the game in in Brazil right now is to develop a professional's ministry among professional people. And so you have more time there. A guy graduates when he's 26, and he'll die when he's 76. So you got 50 years with him, see? And that's a lot better than five. You know, you can build a lot of momentum in 50 years. And so the idea there is to, you know, the university ministry is kind of the doorway into a guy's life, and then he goes on and is fruitful from there on out. So that's kind of the vision of the ministry in Brazil. Well, Argentina, just getting started there, have three couples, two Americans and a Latin couple. And the two Americans have been there for 6 months, and they're just at the peak of their culture shock. And that's a tough deal, because, you know, when you're 6 months into the culture, you know enough language to know what you don't know. And at first, you know, you think that, you know, in 3 months you're going to be fluent, and so you sail into the language, and gradually, you know, reality sets in, and it just takes a long time. And so they're not, you know, they can pass the time of day, and they can kind of dabble around on the surface in relationships with people, but they can't communicate beyond, you know, talking about the time of day or the weather or the price of potatoes and things like that. And, you know, here they are, they want to, you know, get into a relationship with people, and they can't because of language problem. And then also, they're just setting up their households. They spent, you know, a few months in language study, and now they're setting up households. And when I was there, there's no furniture in the houses, and they don't know where to go to buy them, and they can't communicate with the salesman, you know, at the stores. And so they always think they're getting gypped or something, you know, and so they talk about these Argentines, and it's tough, say. But that'll pass. But the political situation in Argentina is really bad news. It's held together by Perón, who is 78 years old and sick and has been senile for almost 78 years. And he never was a good leader, and he hasn't improved with time. So when he goes, things could very well break loose. And so we talked about escape routes and where to go when it blows up and things like that. So appreciate your prayers for the gang there. Well, that's probably enough, you know, of a rundown. Maybe we'll get in some questions now. I didn't make that clear. Our basic strategy, as I understand it today, I may change next week, is that we're going to establish four power bases in Latin America: Mexico, Venezuela, Brazil, and Argentina. And by a power base, I mean countries that have the potential to not only meet its own needs, but to export. And so we have no plans to go into the other countries for now. And the reason is this: we could populate these other countries with people because they are available. But the people here want a piece of the action. And like, they took me to task for dumping two Americans into Argentina without consulting with them. They said, well, now maybe we wanted to send more. See, and they feel that they have got to have a share in the responsibility for getting these other countries. And so I can't sit here in Colorado Springs and decide, well, let's send three into Colombia this year and four into Chile next year and lay the plans and then advise them. Because these men are budding strategists themselves, and they have the same vision that I have. And so they just want a piece of the action. And one of the things we have to watch, and the thing we've been working toward all the way along, is that we produce an indigenous division. And by indigenous, I mean that it that the philosophy of the ministry, the the economics of it, the form, the leadership, and the vision of the ministry be Latin. Now, that does not mean that we do not bring in foreign influences, but it does mean that we do not do anything that violates the Latin cultures. And what it means is that we maintain a balance of power. For instance, you can very easily, right now, we could snuff out the work in Brazil by sending more people in there. That's a fact. Because what would happen is we have a certain amount of Latin influence there, a certain amount of American influence there. Right now, and when I was there, it was an American work run, it was an American work assisted by Latins. When I left, it became a Latin work assisted by Americans. Now, if we bring in more men right now, it'll turn the balance again. And it's a lot easier to occupy geography, you know, just put men in cities, than it is to establish a national work. And so when you have a national work that is coming along and is developing, you have to be very careful to allow it to grow and to develop. And once it's grown up and these men gain a little bit more altitude, then we can begin to slip some more people from other countries in under the national leadership. And that's not going to take very long. For instance, Aldo is a dentist. He's had 4 years of seminary. He's a lot better educated than I am, and he's smarter than I am. And so, you know, he's 35 years old. And so, you know, you take a guy that's 26, 27, like Bo Young is a very gifted guy, and he's going to Brazil as soon as he gets his papers. So we can slip people in under the leadership, but you have to go in at the rate that they're able to assimilate them.
Mm-hmm. On what basis do you select your power base?
Well, mostly on the basis of objective data, like its potential for producing qualified men. One of them, for example, the difference between Colombia and Venezuela on paper, they look almost identical, Colombia and Venezuela. Colombia, as a matter of fact, has an edge in some areas. But you look at the Colombian, he has a very weak self-image. The nation has a very weak self-image. They kind of consider themselves a colony of the U.S., a rebellious colony of the U.S. or something like that. Well, the Venezuelan has a very... he feels that he's the leader of Latin America. And so do the Argentines. And the Brazilians know they are. See? And so, see what I'm saying is that just the mentality of the people, while the guys in Costa Rica, one of the guys says, well, I'm just a Tico. Which means I'm a Tico, something that's small. And which means is I was born in Costa Rica, and he feels that says it all. In other words, he's a complex about himself just because of where he was born, where he comes from. And so you look at a country and say, okay, now, could a world leader come out of this country? Or could a Latin American leader come out of this country? And you say, well, yes. Well, I doubt it. And so those are the countries you go to first.
Languages like Spanish and Portuguese, they can be learned here before the one would go, but it doesn't seem like you do that.
Yeah, that's a good question. And a lot of people, you know, try to get into the language ahead of time. And I would say this, it all depends on what you want to do in a language, where you learn it. Now, if all you want to do is communicate, then learn it here. See, but if you want to achieve perfection, wait and learn it there. Because pronunciation is just a matter of habit. You form habits. And matter of fact, speaking is almost, you know, total, purely habit. It's automatic. You've programmed your mind, and so it just comes out. And if you program the wrong sounds in there, you'll have an accent all your life. Uh-huh. Well, the problem is, For one thing, learning a language is not just learning to speak, but it is assimilating a culture. And every word in a language carries a cultural baggage along with it. And so you actually change as a person when you learn another language in the context of that culture. You are no longer purely Canadian, or do you become purely Brazilian? You become some other thing, see? But it does modify you, because language is not just learning to communicate ideas. And so I think it's important that you learn it in the context of the culture.
So there's a lot of difficulties that's worth it going through then, from learning it there, like these people here.
Yes. Yeah.
Knowing the language would help in certain other areas.
I think the thing that we're after, if you're going to spend your life there, the thing that we're after is perfection. And if that's our objective, then we have to go about it in such a way that that will be the result. And so I think that's the point. So you're going to ask first, and then you.
How long would it take to learn a culture, learn and assimilate this culture into your life? How long would you talk about culture?
Good. Well, Portuguese is a lot more difficult than Spanish, and it takes you longer. I'd say it takes, for the first 18 months, every time you open your mouth, you're aware of those weird sounds that come out, and you feel, it doesn't feel natural. And depends on the person. The average person, it takes him about 3 years before he's really communicating and integrated. But it takes longer than that, even maybe 5 or 6 years to really make the cultural adaptation to any significant extent. That is, if you work at it. Spanish is a little bit less time. So you're next, okay?
I think it was in Brazil you had the two ministries, the pagan and the church.
Uh-huh.
Is there no church fellowship, here with the pagan side of the house? Are these people, when you meet in the home on Sundays for fellowship and this kind of thing, as opposed to going to church and then coming back and having a fellowship in the home or something like that?
The question you're asking is, what do these people, the non-religious Christians, do for fellowship? They meet their needs for fellowship. They become sort of a body, and they'll be over. And it happens all the time, just spontaneously. A house will cram up with people, and they're just there. They're having a barbecue or something together, but they have no regular meetings. They get together consistently, as small groups of maybe 20, 30 people. But they kind of play it by ear. A lot of these people are in small Bible study groups. There are personal relationships, very strong personal relationships that kind of hold these people together. A lot of personal interest in each other. And so there's probably a great deal more fellowship going on among the non-religious people than there is among the religious people. They probably get more nourishment and more instruction, exhortation, and more opportunity to grow than the religious people do. But it's more just in the course of life. Does that answer your question? Okay, I think, let's see, who was next? You were next. Huh?
It's kind of going back to one thing that I asked you about before, but what is the balance between not judging a person for something like that we think is different than wrong, like this bit of a line,
mm-hmm.
or else, and then you mentioned too about teaching them how to live, how to get along with your family.
Mm-hmm.
What is the balance?
Well, I never would have dared to try to teach the things that we're teaching now 10 years ago. As a matter of fact, I don't think I could do it now. But what we're doing now comes as a result of producing men who can think for themselves and can analyze the scriptures accurately on their own. And these ideas and concepts that are coming out are national in origin. And so there are some things which are universal. You know, Paul's letters have a lot of cultural content to them, like he tells the women, you know, in Corinthians to wear veils on their heads as a sign of authority. Well, see, if you can take that literally, then when you go to church, you put a veil on your head. But what he's talking about there is the subject of authority. And that's a principle which is always applicable. And so what we try to do is sort out those things that are always applicable and apply them to the local situation. But not the danger is imposing something from up here on here. But we would never dare do this if we did not have strong men of the word in our gang who could do it for us. Work with us. And until then, you just have to let it go. Said, let things go until the time is ripe. Okay? See, I don't know who was next. I think you've been waiting for a long time, okay?
Mm-hmm.
That's a very good question. And I would answer it this way, that you find in the epistles, in many places, a reference to those men who are in the ministry full time. And probably the key passage is 1 Corinthians chapter 8, where it says, now, does anyone go to work on his, does anyone go to war on his own finances? What about the ox that grinds the corn? Was it really about oxen that God was concerned about? Or is he teaching a principle here? A man is worthy of his hire. And so what he's teaching here is that there are people who are full-time in the ministry. It's not a matter of either or, but it's a matter of when more than anything else. And we found another thing, that in some of the denominations, some of the churches, they have, because of the economic difficulties in the country, they do not have a robust economy like they have in North America. Like the Presbyterians will have call a pastor to it, a huge urban church, and pay him $100 a month. Well, it'll cost him $1,000 a month to live. And so he will have maybe three or four other little jobs that he's doing, none of which he really does to excellence. And same thing in the university system there. A guy teaches law, he also has a law practice. Or a doctor teaches medicine, but he also has a medical practice. And so he never really does either one with excellence. And so I think that what we need to do is move people toward going full-time. And there's another thing here, too, and that is that where people have got to give. And we found that if a new Christian does not start to give very soon, he stops growing. And so it's as much for the sake of the Christians that are coming on that we maintain a balance of people going into the ministry with the financial reserves, the potential reserves that need to be tapped. And so we will always be putting people into the ministry, but it'll be in accord with the reserves that begin to emerge. And they will be quite large, see, because once we begin to reach professionals, which we are beginning to do now, you know, our potential financial strength, I think, is very good in, over the long run.
Okay, can I just ask one question? You said it's not a question of either or, it's a question of when.
Yeah.
Is that for everyone?
Well, I think that God separates some people unto the gospel. And, you know, it took me years to admit that that's what God had done with me. In fact, I'd been in Brazil for years when I finally admitted, well, God has separated me into the gospel. And you don't really know that. You don't say, I don't think you can say right now, well, I have a call from God. Maybe you can. I couldn't say, well, I have a call from God to give myself to the gospel. You know, when you're 20 years old and trying to figure out what God's will is for you. And that's kind of cheating because if you come to me and say, well, I have a call from God to give myself to the gospel, well, for me to disagree with you is to disagree with God. And to impugn your relationship with God. See, it's hardly fair to use that argument. I believe this way, that if God is separating me into the gospel, my fruit is going to push me into the ministry. And I won't have any choice. See? And I think what we did is we picked guys, and they're winners, the guys that we picked, but they hadn't been pushed into the ministry. So we had to go back and let them get pushed in. Okay?
The Latin being so relation-oriented, how does that affect things like, evangelism or small group Bible study, or things like we think of man-to-man time, and trading our concepts?
Yeah. Evangelism, man-to-man time, small group and training, okay? Well, the guys in Brazil never go out and evangelize. Just don't do it. And the reason they don't is because they don't have to. Because they're getting more new Christians than they can handle without it. Because they really, truly have communication with the world. You have to go out and evangelize when your group is cloistered with walls around it in the world. Then you have to sneak out and knock on a door and dart back in and say, I witnessed. See? But if your people are truly in the world, then they'll knock on it, like this Mario Nietzsche. He has a work in Curitiba now. He was a communist when I met him. He was leading a communist cell group. And then he began to believe in God, and they kicked him out, and he went into a terrorist group. And then he took me along one time, and they suspected that he was with the CIA, and so they kicked him out, that I was with the CIA, and so they kicked him out, and he left in a rage. And it was just an act of God, because in about 2 months after that, the Brazilian government, crunched that group, and a lot of them wound up in jail, and some of them went into hiding. And now, years later, some of these guys are in that cell group, are still on the lam from the government, but they'll sneak into Mario's home and study the Bible for a couple of hours and sneak out again. See, because he has not severed his relationships with those kind of people. And so in evangelism, I would say that the training is more in how to take advantage of how to be in the world and how to take advantage of those things that do exist. See, we do not bring them into our world. See, as soon as you bring these guys into our world, then you cut off everything that they could do. So we have to be going to their world and help them exploit their natural situations. And that, of course, is the kind of thing that they'll do when they're 50 years old. See, we have to think, when we think of our methods, we have to think in terms of, what kind of evangelism do you after you're 30? Well, 50 years old, they're not going to go out and knock on dormitory doors. Or, they're not going to go through the barracks. Or, they're not going to go out to the airport and witness to people, stuff like that. That's artificial. And so the training on that level is training men in light of what they're going to be doing all their lives. And what we do is we help them be successful in that. We get involved and work behind the scenes to help them be successful. And that's a highly individualistic thing. Now, with the follow-up and things, that becomes more of a group enterprise. But every person that comes into the group has a spiritual daddy with whom he is, you know, has been studying the Bible, and so there's a strong personal tie, but mainly he gets his help from the group. And we found that this works better and produces better growth than something that is highly individual, you know, highly personal. Because sometimes you put a guy, give a guy too much personal attention, and he's kind of in the spotlight. And it's more than he can take. And but then when it comes to training, you think, well, this is a question that often comes up. You know, if you're dealing with all these individualists, how in the world do you get two of them to go in the same direction at the same time? See, how in the world can you have a team effort? How can you make the ministry progress? Well, that's very simple. In the basics, you know, which is the wheel, and the wheel, incidentally, I believe, we just turn that into the wheel. The wheel, I think, deals with universals. That's why it's going to survive. But I lost my train of thought. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, now I got it. Now, the basics are individualistic to a great degree there. I'm not saying it should be in Canada. You know, don't go back as a bunch of rebels. But there it is. Well, so guys will come to a Bible study group, and everybody will have prepared the study sort of after his own style. But he has prepared the study. He has studied the Bible, see? And everybody will have a relationship with God in prayer, but it'll be quite individualistic. So what we look for is the result, the effect. And we want to see, is this man, does he really have the basics in his life? And you look not at what he does, but what he becomes. That's the criteria. Well, but once the basics are in his life, then we think, well, we need to go from here to there. We have to implement our vision. We need people. We need to be, you know, of one heart and mind and soul and do the same thing together. Well, this is where the team concept comes in. And, you know, we take off on it from, you know, Nehemiah and his team. You know, 42 groups of people in 52 days it took them to build a wall. I forget what it was. But, you know, he had all these teams. David had teams. Jesus had. And so we point out to the gang that they have got, you know, to function, they've got to become a part of a team. Well, what does a team imply? Well, you know, in Brazil, they're fanatic for soccer. That's the national religion. And so... and they're very stringent about their team members. For instance, if a player does not show up for what they call the concentration, which is kind of a 2-day isolation period before a game, if he shows up late or doesn't show up, he's off the team. You know, they're very demanding on that level. Well, in the same way, you know, if we're going to carry on our ministry, the guys who are individuals in their private lives become team members in their ministry lives. And then they do it together. So that's, you know, how we work it out on the training level. Then on the building level, or you know, what we're really after, I don't think that very many men can handle that kind of attention, the kind of attention that I gave Aldo. But, you know, there are always maybe half a dozen men on the scene in the country who can handle that. And so what we do there is we step into his world or have him step in our world, and we just live together for a period of several years, possible. So about the only place where there is any kind of regimentation is on the team level.